Thank you. Welcome, everybody, and good afternoon. So the talk I'm going to present today is about how to add robustness to a secure stacked file system with untrusted local storage components. And we do this with a special emphasis on keeping the implementation complexity and the security issues that might arise from that complexity low. So let me first introduce the context in which we did this work. And in order to do that, I would like to start with an example or a concept that everybody knows about, and that is virtual private networks. Now, VPNs provide us with a way to securely use an insecure network, such as the internet, that we normally would not want to trust if we want to exchange secure or security critical messages. Now, in terms of security, what VPNs provide us with is, for once, not availability, because someone can always cut the cable and so release the, lose the connection to the network, but they do provide us with confidentiality and integrity in the sense of tamper detection through cryptographic means. Now, what you can do is you can take this idea and apply it to file systems too. So instead of reusing an untrusted network, you can actually reuse a file system that, for whatever reason, you consider not secure enough for your data. For example, because it is part of a large monolithic Linux kernel that you think can too easily be penetrated. Now, if this, the platform that you are using is providing you with virtualization capabilities, you can actually have the secure part of the file system and the insecure part that you are reusing on the same system. And if the virtualization layer is fairly small, for example, if it's a microkernel or a very small hypervisor and it provides you with very strong isolation primitives, you can actually achieve that an application that you want to provide with file system functionality can have a much smaller trusted computing base than if it were running on top of the large Linux kernel. Now, this is actually what we did in earlier work on VPFS, the virtual private file system. And what we achieved with that system is that we could actually reduce the amount of code that an application needs to trust for file system security by an order of magnitude, well below 5,000 lines of code. These 5,000 lines of code, or a little bit less, include basically abstractions for files and namespaces, and a buffer cache, and of course all the cryptography in order to securely reuse the commodity file system that does storage management and provides us with device drivers. From a logical point of view, this makes VPFS a stacked file system where the small secure part on top is strictly isolated from the commodity file system, but we still have some correlation between these two, which is established by a proxy component in between that knows how to talk to both components. Now, let me briefly introduce you to how the internal workings of VPFS are and where its implementation is still lacking a bit. And that is robustness, which in the main part of the talk I'm going to explain how to add securely to the system. I will then discuss evaluation results briefly before I conclude the talk with the lessons we learned. Now, let's take a look at how this works on the inside. So basically, everything you see on the top in this green box is basically a memory file system that is operating inside a buffer cache. So we have user data that is stored in files. These files are organized in blocks. And in order to achieve persistency, we map these files to physical files in the Linux file system that we are reusing. And of course, these files are encrypted before they reach Linux, so Linux cannot spy on our data. We also have metadata, for example, inodes or directories, and they are also organized in files and mapped to their own files in the Linux file system. So encryption is one thing, but for certain applications and also for system services that you want to target with this file system, you might need integrity too. And this includes, for example, the ability to detect whether or not a certain file was rolled back to an older version or was entirely removed. And in order to achieve that, we added a hash tree to VPFS, which has the nice property that it can reduce integrity information of a large data set, such as an entire file system, to a single hash that we can then store securely in some sealed memory, for example, as provided by a TPM. Now, it turns out that this hash tree is also a source of major headaches when it comes to making the system robust. Why is that? So let's assume a user file or a block from a user file needs to be evicted for some reason from the buffer cache. What you then have to do is you also have to update all the other blocks in the hash tree that store the hash sums up to the root that describe the integrity information of this newly modified block. So this for once means that you have high overhead because there are many writes and also a lot of crypto operations. And now if you start to write back the data and the system crashes at, for example, this point in time, you might actually have a problem, because if you now have to recover the file system from the encrypted files in the Linux file systems with only some of the blocks updated, we won't be able to check the integrity of the red blocks because the top level nodes of the hash tree have not been updated yet. This actually happened to us, and this bothered us a lot. So what we have to do is we have to update these blocks atomically for the entire set of tree nodes that is updated. Now, this basically means that we need a consistency mechanism in our file system, something that we already have in the untrusted file system underneath, but now we also want it in the trusted computing, in the trusted component of the file system. If you look at this problem, you will quickly find out that this is a fairly complex problem, and the correct implementation of these consistency mechanisms is often difficult to get right. Bugs are in corner cases that are rarely exercised or triggered, or error code checking is incomplete. And the best thing is, or the worst, this also happens with widely used file systems we might be using every day. So this motivated us to try to keep all the complexity and potential security issues of such an approach out of the trusted computing days. So we want this functionality, but want to have as much of the complexity in the untrusted part of the file system stack. So coming back to the hash tree, there is an efficient solution that can be used to address the update problem for a distributed structure like this tree. And that is, for example, journaling. So the idea here is whenever we need to update a block at the leaf level of the tree, we do not update the top level tree nodes, but instead we record the new hash sum in the journal. And only after that, we update the block in the untrusted file system in the encrypted file. Now, this we can do with all the other blocks. And of course, the idea is that if the system crashes at some point, we will be able to authenticate the updated block or maybe the old version of the block with either the hash sum from the journal or the hash sum that is still stored in the old version of the persistent copy of the tree. This really works well for user data blocks, and it is also quite efficient in terms of complexity inside the trusted computing base. So, for example, all the trusted computing base has to do is calculate the hash sum of the new block, encrypt it, and put this data into some shared memory ring buffer, for example, that is accessible by the untrusted part of the file system stack that can then do all the difficult work, like, for example, instruct the legacy file system to do an ordered write, basically to make sure that the hash sum is updated in the journal first and then the block is written. And since this functionality is not really trusted, we can also afford optimizations such as write batching, for example, or if consistency constraints are not violated, we might even relax the write ordering. This really works well for user data blocks, as I said, and we were wondering if we could actually apply the same approach to metadata blocks too, like, for example, directory blocks. In the end, we decided not to do so, and the reason is that we found another solution that makes the complexity that we have to add to the trusted computing base a lot smaller. And this approach is based on locking metadata operations instead of locking metadata blocks. And the reason why this is simpler is if we are logging operations, we can actually reuse APIs that we already have during recovery. It's also the case that we found dependency tracking of all the objects we need to consider for file system consistency easier. So, for example, we don't have to track multiple blocks that might even change if we rename a directory and names move from one directory to another. Also, the implementation is less intrusive. Now, what kind of dependencies am I talking about? Since we are doing journaling at the operation level for metadata operations, we of course have to make sure that in order to be able to replay these operations, we need all the parameters that an application or at one point submitted to the file system. For example, for new files, this is the inode of the new file, the name of the file, and some directory where this new directory entry shall be created. There are similar dependencies for other operations. And I now want to give an example of, for example, how we track the creation of new files in order to make sure that we can correctly and securely log the metadata updates. So the file system that is implemented inside the buffer cache already provides a lot of infrastructure. So for example, there's the file descriptor table, and each file descriptor has a pointer to the inode. So we quickly find the inode. What we had to add in JVPFS in order to make it robust is that we keep also track of all the parameters for file creation, and we store this basically in extension of the file descriptor table. So, for example, we have the name of the file, the inode number of the parent directory, and we also have the file descriptor number of the parent directory in the case that it is still open and might still have to be locked. So this table can be maintained in just a couple dozen lines of code, and what it gets us is it allows us to, for example, figure out if we want to flush a file and there's an entry in this new file table, we quickly find out that a file name called file42 has to be created in a directory DIR that also has to be locked. Now, how does this all work in concert? Let's assume we want to flush a file. And before we actually get to flushing that user data block, our dependency tracking code figures out that it first has to create, in reverse path name order, the parent directory, so it adds a file create record to the journal, then does the same for the file itself, and only after that we can flush the blocks and record the hash sums of the newly written blocks in the journal. What we also do is, from time to time, we flush metadata blocks. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to explain all the details about that, but this is explained extensively in the paper. So if you want to know the details, please have a look there. Now, what about security of the journal? There's a new data structure we added, and actually, since we are doing operation-level locking, all the parameters that an application once submitted to the file system have to go into that log. So we have to worry about confidentiality, and that is why, for example, we encrypt file names and inodes and other parameters. There are some parameters, though, that we cannot encrypt. And these are, for example, block offsets of blocks and the type of blocks, so whether it's user data or metadata. Again, the details of this distinction are on the paper. The key point here is that we need to keep this information plain text because the untrusted code actually has to cooperate with the secure part in order to make sure that it can securely and in a consistent way write back blocks. We also added tempo detection because in the case of replay, we want to make sure that we replay a correct file system state. And what we basically do is we put the anchor of the journal, which is some root information, into the sealed memory that we already use for the root hash sum of the hash tree. And we also, from time to time, add keyed hashes to the journal that basically describe the contents of all preceding journal records. This actually forms record groups, which I'm going to explain on the next slide, which covers the recovery procedure. So let's assume the system crashed and we have to recover. The first thing that needs to be done then is we have to first recover the legacy file system. This is some functionality we can just reuse. The next step that happens is we identified complete record groups in the journal, in the JVPFS journal. So this basically means, like shown on this slide, that these three records can be considered a record group as they are terminated by a hash keyed hash that describes the integrity information of that. The third step that is done then is all metadata blocks that may still exist in the encrypted file containers in the Linux file systems are rolled back to the version that was valid just before the journal started. The details about that are again in the paper, and the reason why we have to do this is if we want to replay all the operations that are recorded in the journal, we of course have to do this relative to some metadata state, and that is precisely the state before the journal started. So all this information all these operations up to here are actually untrusted operations. They are not security critical, they are only critical for availability. The security critical part of the operation kicks in afterwards. So what the trusted part of the file system stack then does is it reads the root info, which is something like the superblock, and basically establishes a clean state of the basic metadata structures. After that, replay starts, which basically works by getting all the complete record groups that the untrusted code identified. We then check the integrity. So we recalculate these hashes of the records and compare them with the hashes that are stored in the untrusted, in the journal itself. So these are keyed hashes, basically signatures. And if they match, we can be certain that the data has not been modified and no records have been omitted or moved around. So this guarantees us that in the next step, when we re-execute the operations through the existing APIs, we are actually re-executing operations that the application before the crash at some point submitted to the file system. And of course, we do all this until there are no more complete record groups. There are maybe some records at the end of the journal that might fall off the table because we cannot authenticate them, but, well, that's bad luck. Okay, some more words about corroboration. So mostly I, up to now, talked about how the security critical functionality in the scheme looks like. But we are actually reusing a complete commodity file system. And in fact, we are also reusing the consistency primitives these file systems might provide to us. So for example, journaling or even data journaling or copy on write schemes can be used in order to express the write before relationships we have for journal record updates and block writes. If a file system provides more expressive primitives such as write ordering or snapshots, we can also reuse them. And the latter one is especially interesting for checkpointing and journal truncation, which is explained in the paper in detail. I don't have the time to cover it right now. And also the paper covers flushing metadata blocks. Now, coming to the evaluation, how complex is all the functionality we added to this file system in order to make it robust? If we look at commodity file systems such as RiserFS or ext4, we quickly find that just the code in order to make these systems robust against crashes is in the order of thousands of lines of code. JVPFS actually only needs 325 lines of security critical code in order to make sure that the file system can be brought back into a consistent state after a crash. Now, of course, this is not the entire functionality, so we are reusing all the APIs we have implemented in the core functionality of the trusted file system component, for example. And of course, we are also reusing whatever the untrusted legacy file system provides us in the first steps of recovery, but also in properly ensuring write ordering, for example. But still, a reduction of complexity in the security critical code of an order of magnitude is significant. So does this system actually work, and is it effective? So, of course, we tested this, and with the original version that didn't do any journaling, we regularly lost data. So we did a test, and we simulated the unpacking of a tar archive, and this benchmark basically generates a few thousand files. Also, a lot of metadata is generated because files are created, and a lot of data is written. And what we did now is we power cycled the machine, which, of course, interrupted write back, and then we recovered the JVPS file system stack, as I explained earlier. Now, what you expect is that all the files that can be recovered should actually be readable. And all the files that could not be recovered or maybe not even have been written at all should not be accessible, of course, but there should also be no error except for maybe that there is no such file. And this actually worked pretty well, so we tested this with various hardware configurations. So, for example, we used NILFS on a flash storage device. We also tried a traditional or more traditional configuration with RiserFS on a hard disk, and recovery time is pretty okay too. Now, in terms of performance, I don't want to give too many details here. There's a detailed discussion in the paper. I just want to focus on a few things. So what you would expect is, since JVPFS is a stacked file system and there's encryption and strong isolation and virtualization, you would expect that there is some overhead. And indeed there is. So if you look at the white bars, which basically represent the execution time, so on the y-axis smaller is better, of benchmarks being executed on native Linux without any encryption directly on the file system, you will find that the JVPFS runtimes are actually larger. Except for one case, which is the second set of bars, and that is the one I would like to discuss a bit more detailed now. So this particular benchmark is actually a postmark trace, and the characteristic of this benchmark is that it creates a lot of files, and these files are actually modified too. So whenever the application writes a file, the data is written to the buffer cache and maybe eventually to the storage device, and afterwards the same block might be modified again. And the particular file system we are using in this benchmark, which is NILFS, this is a log-structured file system, actually has a very interesting property, and that is it serializes all writes. So it guarantees write ordering whatever the application sent to the file system in the same order this appears on the storage device. So unfortunately, for the Linux benchmark, this also means that a lot of data is generated because multiple blocks are written twice, because no block write coalescing can happen. In the JVPFS case, where we have our secure file system component on top of that, we can actually absorb a lot of these writes, and so less data ends up written to the storage device. The other interesting thing here is that since NILFS provides this nice write ordering property, we can actually avoid a lot of hassles that we usually would have with ensuring that journal records are written before modifying blocks. It just works because the system enforces the order. And this basically explains why we have a rather low difference between the case where we don't have journaling, so this is basically the old behavior, and journaling added. So the difference here we see is basically the additional amount of data that is generated because of journal writes. This is a bit different in the hard disk configuration you see on the left, where we have RISOFS, which doesn't support this feature, and we actually have to use fsync, which is expensive on magnetic disks. Okay, so what are the lessons we learned? So we could show that for a file system that already has a very small trusted computing base and is secure in terms of confidentiality and integrity, it only requires less than 350 lines of code in order to make the system robust too. That's, of course, the code in a trusted computing base. We think that we identified a security critical core for journaling and replay, and this is basically because of the high level of abstraction we use, for example, logging metadata operations and not blocks, which enables replay at the API level, and we could also reuse a lot of code that was already there. But the most important thing and the most important insight is that we can actually delegate a lot of complexity that consistency in a file system requires to the untrusted file system and just reuse that. And we can even reuse consistency primitives these file systems already provide, sometimes with very interesting performance and implementation complexity aspects. And that basically concludes my talk, and I'm very happy to answer any questions.
Dan Peek from Facebook. I think this is really interesting. Quick question is, what can you do to protect the confidentiality of files for which things like file size is a strong identifier, like for MP3s or something like that?
Yeah, so confidentiality is only possible at the block level. So if you can infer something from the size of a file, you're lost. This is because we are mapping all files in the virtual private file systems to files in the Linux file system. The benefit we get from this, of course, is that we can delegate a lot of work like block allocation for files and storage management to the untrusted file system. So this is basically the trade-off we made.
But you actually considered that?
Well, we considered it and we accepted it.
I have one question that in slide 7 or 8, you mentioned that you can enforce order the write. I wonder how did you do it? And is there any performance overhead for that?
So basically, there are multiple answers to this question. So what we have to make sure, if we are updating an existing block, what can happen is that we lose the hash sum that is necessary in order to authenticate it. And that's why we first write updated hash sums to the journal. Then we do so this basically requires an ordered write, for example, fsync, or a file system that does write ordering and makes sure that afterwards we write the new version of the block, that this happens in a specific order. We always have the hash sum we need. But quite often, for example, when unpacking these files from the tar archive, for example, we don't overwrite data. So in this case, we can actually relax the write ordering constraints, and we just write the journal records, and we just write the file contents, and let the legacy file system decide what is best to write first. So there's literally no overhead. This is actually what you see on the right with these benchmarks. So even on the hard disk configuration for the UNTOR benchmark on the right, you see a little difference between journaling enabled and journaling not enabled. So we avoid ordered writes altogether in many cases.
So you said in the beginning you do something for the controller, and you say you write something, then after that you write another thing. So if you just do this two-step, you write something, you write another thing, so the underlying system could still reorder it, right? How do you enforce?
Yeah, so one thing I forgot to mention is we are also doing write batching. So actually we are coalescing many hundreds of writes to the journal and many block writes. So we first write a bunch of journal records, and then we write a bunch of blocks. This also helps.
So even say you do batch and you issue one write, but the controller may break up your one write to multiple ones. And I'm wondering, is there any probability that could also be reordered?
I didn't quite
get. So my question is, you say you do batch, right?
Yeah.
In one batch, usually we assume it should be in that order because it's one operation. But the problem is, the underlying system may even break up that one operation to multiple ones. Then they could possibly do reordering. That's my kind of concern.
So of course we end up with having multiple operations, but if you are using a file system that just uses fsync, we mainly have to worry about the journal. And if you are overwriting blocks, we also may have to worry about files, but actually we can deal with that. So this is not a real problem. And if you have a file system that is guaranteeing write order, you can just rely on that. And even if there are multiple operations on the storage controller, that's basically what the underlying file system guarantees you, and we can rely on that. I'm not sure if I actually got this question right. I hope I did. Otherwise, we can also discuss offline.
Okay, thank you.
Let's thank the speaker again.